Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Well, Dan, I am ready to play devil's advocate occasionally here and stuff like that. I anything I throw at you, here's my rules. Coming from a place of affection from me, thinking of a lot of people and voices from the background, and whenever you feel like me saying you, Dan Peterson, I'm probably most likely meaning the apologetic enterprise in general. And so however you want to always say, I'm upset with that too. Yeah. You know, feel free to do all that stuff. So we're going to kind of you're our guy representing, but I know that you're not necessarily always.
Now this is the point where I snarl and lie a lot.
Okay. Yeah. And
all right.
Your head spins around.
Good. Yeah. Projectile vomiting.
Ouch. Yeah. That's enough distance here. I'll risk that. Okay. So. As you began, you began to introduce a little bit about farms and a third of the budget this, a third of the budget this. So snarkle puss or smart demon or in the back of my head saying, okay, you say it comes out of an interest in the ancient world.
Yeah.
Does it really? Why would BYU, why would this nonprofit organization that, you know, it began as attract people that really just want to do that, unless there was some sort of sense of, we love the ancient world because we think the Book of Mormon fits within the ancient world. We love the ancient world because we think our religion harkens back and has its roots in that. So how address that sort of connection there to you know, full on the critic that sort of suspects you to do something.
Well, I won't deny that I think a substantial part of my interest in the ancient world comes from my religious interests. I mean, whatever interest I have is a function of me as a whole person. My whole personality goes into it, my whole background, my whole sensibility, everything else. So I don't know that I can surgically disentangle the one from the other. Yeah, I'm interested in it. On the other hand, I write about topics in antiquity and Islam that have nothing to do with Mormonism sometimes.
And there's no sense of...
No.
I should be doing something more important that might save us all.
Right.
You know,
It's my job. It's what I do. I mean, I think an engineer does engineering. Maybe that's not saving souls, but it's important to do. And so I've devoted a lot of time to teaching Arabic grammar, you know. And I can actually, believe it or not, sometimes get kind of excited about Arabic grammar. It's kind of interesting. I look at the language, the verbal system of Arabic and think, who came up with this? It's genius. It's totally unlike the English system. So those sorts of things interest me. I get interested in certain philosophical issues. I have other interests besides religion. I'm very political, for one thing. Political philosophy interests me. And so Al-Farabi and people like this are major political philosophers as well as philosophers of religion. So you have someone like Leo Strauss, the great University of Chicago political philosopher, who spent a lot of time on Al-Farabi and Maimonides. So do I. And I'm interested in those topics. There are other things that get me going, other articles and so on that I write or have written on topics that are quite unrelated to religion. But my primary interest, I'll admit, in the ancient world is the history of religion. I'm not interested particularly in the history of trade or something like that, though I almost once thought of being an economist, and that even that can get me. I can go into a bookstore, and in any section of the bookstore I can find half a dozen books I'd like to read. So I'm that broad. I mean, I don't claim that as a virtue. It's a disability in some ways, but it keeps me going all over the place.
But farms actually fund. How does the funding work? You're a BYU professor, so is all of your salary really BYU, and you're an ancient Near Eastern professor, and that's where your money comes from?
You know, it's all actually quite confusing.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I understand the accounting of it. I'm in the Department of Asian and Near Eastern Languages.
Okay.
And so I'm a full professor there. I teach there and in supporting departments. That is, I've taught Middle Eastern history when the historians weren't available to do it. I have routinely taught Islamic humanities in the Department of Humanities. I've taught in the philosophy department, Islamic philosophy and medieval philosophy and so on. So I get around, but my home is in Asian and Near Eastern languages. And yet,
So all those Maimonides and, you know, these interests are fed by that.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, and this is what I teach.
So Farms really has nothing to say about any of that.
No, although the reason those books came into this organization is simply this. When I started what is now the Middle Eastern Texts Initiative, I found that I was having to go over and do contracts in the administration building. I was having to deal with subcontractors. I was having to deal with the budget. I was having to deal with all those things. It was taking an enormous amount of my time, and I wasn't very good at it. Okay. Meanwhile, there was an organization over here that I was serving on the board of. Actually, I think I may have even been chairman of the board. So I came to them at one point and said, look, you have an accountant. You have people who deal with contracts. This would add 10 minutes a week to their workload. It takes 10 hours a week of mine. Right. Would you be willing to let me transfer this? Because it really has no home. Okay. It's just me.
Okay.
And they said, yeah. And so it moved over here, and it actually has fit rather well. Because, again, it has that common interest in texts, ancient texts, or medieval texts in this case. So you know, those are legitimate interests of mine. I'm genuinely interested. Though I have to say, we just published a book on Avicenna's Physics. In two volumes. It's a major masterpiece of medieval philosophy. Boring as all get out. It is so boring. But we hosted a conference here about a year ago now, up in Park City, of the world's experts on Avicenna's physics. It was sort of like being an anthropologist in an exotic foreign tribe. Mm. So these guys are passionate about it. We'd be driving along. They're not seeing anything. Beautiful waterfall. I try to point it out. They're locked in a debate about Aristotle's theory of essential motion. This is so dull. But there are other areas of philosophy that captivate me. That one doesn't happen to. But useful to do it. It's an important fundamental work in the field.
And is it... Okay, so the reason Farms would say, yay, I support this because we're bringing these guys to Utah, we're exposing them, is it a purely a matter of looks good for the church?
Oh, I don't doubt that some of that plays a role. I mean, the fact is it does. I'll tell you how the translation series got started. When I was in graduate school, I began to notice that the fundamental texts in Islam were not translated. You know, the Quran was and a few others, but most of them, you couldn't get them. Or if they existed, they were in obscure translations published 80 years ago in Pakistan, unobtainable, and so on. And yet, coming out of classics, I knew that almost everything in classics, right. You go to an ordinary bookstore, the Loeb Library is sort of my model.
Right.
But you go to the bookstore, you can find 5 translations of Homer, 4 translations of Plato. Right. It's easy. So a non-specialist can get a pretty good idea of what the Greeks were up to just by going to a good bookstore. But you can't do that, couldn't do that for Islam. And I began to see that as a major gap. Well, at a certain point, when I'd come here, I got a call from Alexander Morrison of the 70. And Elder Morrison wanted to know, he wanted to come down and talk to me, he said. And when he got down, we just met one-on-one for about 3 hours. And he wanted to know, were there ways the university could help us to send a message of friendship to the Islamic world that the church, as a church, could not? Because the church would scare them off. For some reason, people have this notion that Mormons are missionary-minded. I don't know where it comes from, but they have that. And but the university could do something academic that would send a message of respect and friendship. There's no dream of getting missionaries into Riyadh or into Mecca or into Tehran right now. But sending a message of friendship. And we went through a whole bunch of ideas. One idea was an endowed chair of Islamic studies at BYU. I loved the idea because I thought, I have no competition.
Yeah.
I'd get it. I'd almost certainly get it. But that wasn't the best idea because, you know, it'd be sort of like having an endowed chair of Mormon studies at Notre Dame held by a Jesuit.
You know, we'd
wonder, well, we're flattered, but what's he doing?
Yeah.
We might be more paranoid than anything. Likewise, I didn't think that would send the message. But I suggested having a series of translations where we would allow them to speak in their own voice. We wouldn't be doing anything to them except Englishing them, if you will. And he loved the idea. He's a former academic himself. Mm-hmm. Went back to Salt Lake, and they said, let's do it. Now, they didn't give me any money. That was up to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an unfunded mandate.
Yeah.
But that was the approval to go ahead with it, which I loved. Because when I was teaching Islamic philosophy, especially early on, I was limited in what I could teach by what texts were available. It would be sort of like teaching Greek philosophy, but there are no translations of Plato or Aristotle. So you have to go with Theophrastus. And you say, look, there are these two really big philosophers, but we don't have anything from them. So it gives you a distorted view. Well, Avicenna had almost nothing translated. Now we've got stuff.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a legitimate a legitimate contribution? Does it have an underlying ulterior motive? Yeah, I suppose.
Friendship.
Friendship. Well, nothing more than that.
Okay, from Elder Morrison and maybe a few others, yeah. I would guess, and you can say yes or no, there's this sense that Mormons are pure pro-Israel, only Israel. Basically, whatever that government does is just fine and dandy. I imagine, I know President Hunter was one to make sure that we look at both sides and all that. So is there a bit of that behind this too, maybe a little bit balancing out our...
That's a message I personally want to send.
Okay.
That I am not an uncritical supporter of Israel. I am, by the standards of my profession, very sympathetic to Israel.
Okay.
Most Arabists are not at all.
Okay.
By the standards of Mormon Zionists, I am really critical of Israel. I think I'm right about where I want to be. I find myself in gatherings when people are going on and on and on about Israel as just this wonderful shining knight, our ally in the Middle East, practically guiltless. I can't take it, and I have to say things very critical of Israel. When I'm with people who are really pro-Palestinian, I start pointing out, you know, they've done a lot of terrible things. This is not, unfortunately, a conflict with white hats and black hats. I have good friends on both sides. I feel terrible about what happens over there. But nobody is guiltless. So, but I think it's important to send a message, because historically we do have this pro-Zionist leaning. It's been pretty clear. I remember when I was first going over to the Middle East to study, before I left, I was married, just married, but hadn't quite left yet. And we went to maybe I was standing in my own line. I don't think so. I think I was going through someone else's line. And someone said, "So you're going over to Egypt?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What are you going over for?" And I said, "I'm going to be studying Arabic." And he said, really seriously, "Well, I'm on the Lord's side."
Man.
And I just don't react well to things like that. I think to say the Lord has a simple-minded side in this is idolatry.
Crazy. Definitely. All right, so we're back to Fair Farms and sort of the question of, I don't know, working backwards from the conclusion to the evidence. And again, I know that people who send in money generally want their religion to look good.
Sure.
And if they're going to get funded partially from the church, partially from these donors and stuff like that, there's sort of an expectation that you're only going to discover and publish the stuff that matches up. Where does that fall out? How accurate is that?
I don't think it's really accurate. Okay. I think it misconceives what we're doing.
Okay.
We rarely publish articles that argue for the proposition simply, the church is true, or the Book of Mormon is true. There'll usually be an argument that the most likely river for the Riverside in the Book of Mormon is the Grijalva, or something like that. Now, there's nothing in the faith of a Latter-day Saint that entails that conclusion. And there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that would be damaged if we decided it was instead the Usumacinta or whatever other river you want. So we're usually not dealing at that macro level. But I think what the implicit argument is that if the Grijalva works, if it fits, well, that's a nice pointer in the direction of plausibility. It fits. It makes sense. It makes sense of the data in the Book of Mormon. There is a real-world river that fits all the criteria we can isolate. But we don't triumphantly come away from that and say, see, we've proven the Book of Mormon true.
Yeah.
And we rarely are doing that kind of thing, very rarely. And I don't think most of us even believe that it's possible to prove the church true or prove the Book of Mormon true. I do argue that you can make a cumulative case. It's not one that will convince everybody. It's not one that compels belief. But it's enough to tell you that you don't have to crucify your mind to be a believer.
Okay. Well, do you want to outline a little bit what that case would look like, or point us to books that you feel like are at least pieces of that larger case? So what's your best stuff?
Yeah. Well, I'm really impressed with one that wasn't published by Farms of the Maxwell Institute, but came along long before that. That's Richard Anderson's Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses. And all of the other things he's written on the witnesses and some things that other people have done, Lyndon Cook and people like that. I think the witnesses are extremely impressive. And I don't think they can be explained away very well. They seem to be sane. They seem to be honest. They're sincerely convinced of what they claim to have seen and and held. I find that most people now grant their sanity and their honesty. There are a few hardcore anti-Mormons out there who don't, but they're pretty fringe. The most powerful current argument is to say, well, they didn't really see or hold anything. They saw with their spiritual eyes. I think that's privileging certain fringe statements. Because overwhelmingly, the statements of the witnesses, the eight, for example, talk about holding, turning the pages. It's as matter of fact as can be. And when John Whitmer says, for example, they were shown me by a spiritual power, I don't know what he means by that. Maybe simply that God granted him the privilege of seeing them. Because when he describes the experience he had, it's very matter of fact. Afternoon, in a clearing in the woods, turning the pages, they weighed about 60 pounds, and so on and so forth. It's, to me, that's pretty impressive matter of fact testimony. And
so how could plates only weigh 60 pounds?
Oh, because I don't think they were pure gold. I think they were a gold alloy. And if you allow for the fact that a block of plates is not a solid block but has air between each of the plates, is not made out of pure gold but a gold alloy, we actually reprinted an article from years ago in the Improvement Era called Were the Plates of Tumbaga or something like that by Grant Putnam, where he argued there was an actual pre-Columbian alloy, gold alloy, that if you used that as the basis of the plates, would come out to about the right weight.
Okay.
I think it's likely to be something like that. Okay. It would have the appearance of gold. A non-metaller just wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Okay.
But pure gold would be bad for a whole lot of reasons. One, okay. Too heavy.
Uh-huh.
B, way too malleable.
Okay.
It wouldn't retain the writing.
Right. So in the defense of the witnesses, you're saying that's fairly impressive to you. But are you playing offense or are you playing defense there? Because
I'm probably playing defense there.
Okay.
I don't know. It could go either way. I don't know. I would simply say that the witnesses are good evidence that, well, what do they say? They say that this is not some subjective experience of Joseph Smith's alone.
Okay.
Because other people are seeing and hefting and turning the pages of these objects. And it's not just the official witnesses. It's Lucy Mack Smith and Emma Smith and his sister Catherine and so on, who hold the plates, who feel the rings. And flip the plates, and they feel like a book, only thicker. Emma describes rustling the top plate on the ones underneath. It seems to me that there's pretty clear evidence that there was some sort of material object there.
Right, and then the hiding and the moving around and all those different things.
That takes it out of the realm of subjective hallucination, which means to me you can't just rule Joseph Smith out as nuts and say you've explained Mormonism away. That means he's sane, at least, you know, this is very blunt language. He could be lying. He could have faked the plates.
Right.
That, I think, is
Dan Vogel's
position.
Argument.
I don't see it. One of the projects I really like someone to undertake is to make some plates. I want to know exactly what goes into it. I've tried to persuade some engineering friends to do it, but for some reason they're not as excited about my hobbies as I am. They've got other things to do and lives to lead. But I would still like to see people try to create false gold plates. And what goes into it? How much effort would it take? I mean, this is not something that Joseph Smith, I think, had the skill to do. So who did he get to do it? Where's the conspiracy? Where's the evidence for it? On the other hand, you could say everybody's just lying. There were no plates, but I don't see any evidence for that. Again, these men strike me as, well, David Whitmer, for example, honest to a fault. I mean, pig-headedly honest. He would not compromise. I just can't see him going along with a lie. It's not in his character.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that the witnesses force the issues in certain ways. I can, for example, look at Muhammad. I did a paper when I was first in grad school at UCLA. A professor... I was doing a paper for him on the prophetic call of Muhammad. And he saw a draft of it and said, well, I'd like you to do something comparing him to another prophet.
Oh.
Well, it was at the end of the term. You know, I didn't have much time. And so I thought, okay, I know one I can do it on. I did it on Joseph Smith and Muhammad. And I didn't mean it to be any kind of apologetic paper, but at point after point after point, I thought, Muhammad could be explained away. I'm not saying I do, but he could be explained away on the basis of subjective hallucination. Nobody else ever sees anything. Nobody else ever hears anything. There are no material objects that miraculously appear, anything like that. So it's all within his mind. Now, it could still be divine revelation, but Joseph Smith's not that easy to explain away. And I think those material objects, the witnesses, force the issue in a way that it's not forced for Muhammad.
Yeah. It's the plates are a scandal in the sense of
yeah.
you have to deal with them.
Yeah.
And that's takes it into a different realm.
So I remember a conversation with yeah. a friend of mine who's since left the church, a very bright guy, whom I like very much. But he said at one point, well, you know, the plates don't seem to have been used in the translation process. And that's certainly true in a lot of cases. They were in another room or something. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, what function do you think they served? Well, my immediate reaction to him was, well, I think for one thing, they're an absolutely indigestible lump in the throat of people like you mm-hmm. who want to say that it was just Joseph Smith imagining things. Mm-hmm. They just rule that out if mm-hmm. they really existed. Either he deliberately or somebody deliberately made them or something, but he's not just in la-la land. There's a 60-pound material object there. And if you trust some of the other witnesses, there were other objects, lots of plates, Sword of Laban, the Liahona, the breastplate. I mean, these are being treated fairly matter-of-factly. Lucy Mack Smith is holding it, and according to some accounts, I almost think that she saw it uncovered, mm-hmm. the breastplate and the, mm-hmm. you know, and everything. And so where do these things come from? It's hard to explain them away as just, well, it's impossible, I think, to explain them away as just hallucination.
Okay.
So to me, that's a basic chunk of the argument, the cumulative argument I would make.
Okay. And Richard Lloyd Anderson is where you say start.
I always recommend that book that. Okay, to people. I think that's a great book.
Okay.
Even though he's written more since then, I think mm-hmm. it's very, very good. That's the starting point.
Okay.
You know, there are other things. The Farmsish side of me would say, well, then let's look at the content of the book. And there are things in it that, to me, Joseph gets right about the Middle East, for instance, that I just wouldn't expect him to. Now, there are still outstanding issues. Some people accuse me of saying, well, we've proven it true. I don't believe that. There are still outstanding issues. But heavens, there are still outstanding issues regarding Homer. There's still the Homeric authorship question, all these sorts of things. So I don't expect to have all the questions nailed down. But to me, the Book of Mormon ought to be, after it's been examined for as long as it has, it ought to be, if it's a fraud, a pretty obvious fraud. I mean, it's gotten a lot of attention from a lot of bright people. And you can make arguments against it here and there. But on the whole, I think it endures pretty well. And I'm really impressed, for example, now with Grant Hardy's book on understanding the Book of Mormon. I think it's wonderful. I don't think he certainly won't admit to any apologetic purpose in having written it. I've even pushed him, and he won't. And he, all the way through the thing, he says, now I'm just assuming for purposes of argument that it's historical, these are real characters. Mm-hmm. But he's created a really good case, I think, for three very distinct authorial voices in the Book of Mormon. And to me, the most parsimonious explanation of that is there are three distinct authorial voices in the Book of Mormon who happen to correspond very neatly with Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni.
Right.
Now, to me, that's another argument for authenticity, but I see all sorts of links with the ancient Near East and things like that that I find the account of Lehi's travel down the coast of Arabia very, very, very persuasive. Mm. The location of this site of Nahum, you know, in what I see as the right place, the right time, right relationship to another site. These are things that Joseph just isn't likely to have come up with out of the blue. Now, some people will say, well, it's just sheer chance. I suppose so. I mean, this is all subjective.
Sure.
At a certain point.
But it's a cumulative sort of thing.
I may be convinced, you're not. I mean, that's why we have differing opinions on politics and everything else. But it's a rational case to me.
So what about all the outliers? What about all the 19th century evidences, or at least what seems to be? So if you're making your positive case, you also need to sort of deal with the negative.
Yeah, and I think there are those. There are things we still can't explain. Some of them, I would say, could possibly be explained by the nature of the translation. That is, you know, I hear people arguing about whether it's a literal translation or a loose translation. I myself don't know why it has to be either or. When I translate, I go from loose to tight to loose to tight, depending on the sentence, you know, that sort of thing. But I could easily see 19th century vocabulary, even phrases, showing up in the Book of Mormon. Nibley, years ago, did a translation of the Syriac Hymn of the Pearl. And he starts off with the opening line, "In my first primeval childhood." Now, that's not literally what it says.
Right.
On the other hand, that's really what it's trying to say, is something like that. And I think, given his interpretation of the poem, I thought that was a brilliant way of rendering that opening line. I'll tell you an experience I had in graduate school about translation that I've still gotten a kick out of after all these years. I had a seminar in the morning with a professor of Arabic who, for some reason, brought up Edward Fitzgerald's translation of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And he described it as, without question, the single most irresponsible, inaccurate, dishonest translation ever done from an Islamic language into a Western language, which is true. I mean, you can't use Fitzgerald's translation to help you understand the Persian. No quatrain agrees. I mean, it's just, it's very paraphrastic. So he's right. That afternoon, I had a seminar with a Persian professor. I was the only common element between the two classes, and I don't know why Omar Khayyam came up. This fellow described it. It was hilarious to have it happen that afternoon. He described Fitzgerald's translation of the Rubaiyat as, without question, the finest translation ever done from an Islamic language into English, because it captured the spirit, the point of the poem, even though it's not literally accurate. Mm-hmm. And I thought, he's right, too. That's the funny thing. They're both right. It depends what you want from a translation. Yeah. Translation is, by definition, a betrayal of the original text. The only question is how. In what way?
Right. So besides the translation literal and his phraseology and 19th century isms getting in there, what about the, it's fairly convenient that he just, let's just make infant baptism a big, you know, issue here for Moroni at the end of it. Yeah. Where do, is that where you, how do you say that Mormon would pick that out? At least from a scholarly thing, I guess you can say if God, if the Book of Mormon really was prophetic and all that stuff, it works. But can you deal with that piece from a more academic,
We don't know enough about if there was Mesoamerican Christianity, were they having this issue? It's conceivable they were, for the same reason that they began to have it in the Old World. There's a certain logic to it, you know, that gee, if you're not saved, if you're not baptized, we better move it up and make sure that people are baptized early, so, because we have a high infant mortality rate. You know, I might have recourse to the religious answer and simply say, look, if this book really is designed for our day, then you got to give God some ability to inspire the prophet to put in what's going to be relevant to the time that it comes forth.
But if you were writing a book, you don't want to go there.
Right.
But I'd say
there are some issues. Look, I'm quite comfortable with ambiguity. Okay. I'm quite comfortable with standing back and saying, look, you know, I can conceive of several responses to this. I don't have a slam dunk on this one right now. Mm-hmm. But I think there's enough pro to allow me to say, you know, I'm going to give the book the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to convince you on that specific issue taken in isolation? Right. No, probably not.
But adding it all up.
Yeah.
So who is writing that book now? Who should write that book? Has it been written and I'm just not aware of?
The sort of cumulative case?
Yeah, this is sort of the cumulative positive case that,
yeah.
Because everyone else is like, okay, Deer, Taper, you know, you know, all that. You add up all the little things that, okay, at a certain point, if you have to explain so many things away, it just doesn't feel...
Yeah, and of course, it's always going to be subjective where you decide, that is just getting to be too much fudging on the edges for
me.
Some people will say, no, I'm fine. I'm convinced enough of the central core that, you know, you can have a few more of those if you want. It's not bothering me. Others will say it's too much. And, you know, that's a matter of personal sensibility and taste and personal history and everything else. It's we are not computers, and so we arrive at decisions...
Yeah.
At different points.
And good. And somewhere along the line, I want to kind of, especially as we'll talk a little bit later about some of the most difficult issues in Mormonism, that's sort of the key apologist issues that get involved. I kind of want to know that calculus, you know, of how much weight do I give to this versus this.
Well, it's hard to articulate. I mean, I can't come up with an algorithm.
But certain principles sort of, I weigh this way and this way. And
well, I'll give you an example if I can jump ahead on a very different issue, but a huge issue. And that is the question of Joseph Smith and plural marriage.
Okay.
You know, if you look at just that issue, I think that's a very difficult issue for us. I don't think it's quite as difficult now as I used to think it was, say, a year or two ago. I think some new things have come out, a relatively new book by Craig Foster and Newell Bringhurst, an article published in the Farms Review by Greg Smith that really opened my eyes. And actually settled some questions that I had on the subject. So, and there's more coming, as I understand it. But still, I've thought to myself, all right, Think of a friend. Think of someone out there. Think of a person, A, that you don't know at all. And the first thing you hear is a really negative thing about some things he's done that seem to paint him in a really bad light. You have no reason to think positively of him. And so those things really set your image of him. He's a scoundrel. It's very different if this is a friend of yours that you've known for 40 years. He's always been an honorable guy. You have always had the highest respect for him. Now you hear some stories about some things and you think, well, it doesn't sound good, but I'm going to suspend my judgment right now because I'll bet when I talk to him, he'll have an explanation and it will all make sense. Because I've had that experience. We all have. Where you hear
could
something.
His explanation be, I'm a weak man? This is a total screw-up.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay. That would be where I would draw the line and say, no, that would be a little too far for me. Because God still seems, in my view, to treat him as a prophet.
After this, this crap stuff began.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, I have no doubt that is a really difficult issue for a lot of people. And especially if you take it in isolation, it makes Joseph look pretty bad. And what's the most obvious explanation that those of us living, especially in our sex-drenched culture, would come up with? Well, gosh, how many politicians and others have we seen, religious leaders, who it turns out can't keep their pants on?
Right.
This happens all the time. So Joseph Smith's just one more example of that. And yet, if you know somebody really well, maybe you're inclined to say, you know, maybe that's not the explanation. Maybe his explanation that he felt divinely inspired to do this really is true. I think, for example,
could you allow him to be confused about whether it was divinely inspired?
Well, I'll tell you this. I will allow him to be confused about how to do it. People say, well, he was sneaky and all that sort of thing. I'm thinking, well, how would you have handled it? How would I have handled it if I'd been told in an environment that is much more puritanical than my current one is,
right,
to do this? And I'm thinking to myself, this could get me killed. This is going to get everybody that trusts me to hate me. I don't want to do this. So if I do it, I'm going to be sneaking around. It's going to look terrible. It might even make it worse in some ways. I'm willing to allow that, you know, that it was maybe not handled properly. But I always think, how would I have done it? I don't know.
But it sounds like you give some credence to perhaps even an angel with the sword saying,
yeah,
get yourself going on this sucker.
I don't rule it out. No, I think it's possible. I'm a believer. I grant it. I'm inclined to give him very much the benefit of the doubt.
And it's because of this years of experience with him and the authenticity. So
I read things like another book that impresses me is Monk McConkie's book, Remembering Joseph, where he's got these hundreds of testimonials of people who knew the prophet firsthand, and a CD with even more that goes with the book. And they tell a story of a guy who would, you know, walk out of his way to pay off a debt of 37 cents and, you know, that sort of thing. And I just think, I'm not saying he's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not doing that at all. Nobody is. But he seems like a good man to me.
That's how I read him. I mean, when people say, oh, my integrity, you know, is he doesn't match up and stuff. Well, integrity for me demands that I remember those kinds of stories just as much as I remember the ones that don't look bad. And again, it leaves me in a place where it sounds like you are of wanting to give him the benefit of the doubt as much as I can and comfort with the ambiguity.
Yeah.
Though I think I have a little more ambiguity than you. we'll see.
But, you know, I read, for example, the statements that are coming out of his journals and out of his letters that we're seeing in the personal writings of Joseph Smith, even the ones that Dean Jesse did. And there are these little asides, you know, in his journal that he wasn't writing for publication. They're written in this really homely, bad spelling of the early Joseph Smith. And he's praying, oh, Lord, help me to remember thy will. Help me to do the right thing. Be with me, please, I pray. You know, and so on and so forth. Just all the time thrown in. And I think if he's pretending to be pious, man, he's good. But this seems to me unrehearsed, unstudied, unpretentious.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean he couldn't have gotten things wrong down the line. Of course he could have. Everybody can and does. But the idea of him as just being a brazen deceiver who's just cynically manipulating people, I don't believe it. I don't see it in him.
I don't believe that either.
Okay,
polygamy. You see, now we brought it up.
Yeah.
Well, I still want to go back a little bit to the Book of Mormon.
Sure.
But the polygamy piece, from an outsider perspective, who don't have this familiar with Joseph Smith, I think your idea of, if this is the first thing or one of the first things you hear, it's going to be arm's distance from this guy.
Yeah.
What about for the lifelong member who, you know, made it to age 38 without even hearing that Joseph Smith was a polygamist?
Yeah. Well, you know
himself,
what?
You know,
I'm sometimes accused, I'm routinely accused of wanting to suppress uncomfortable facts and everything. Mm-hmm. My view is exactly the opposite. I would rather get all the stuff out on the table. Okay. I would rather have, to borrow a medical image,
inoculation.
Yeah. I've talked with Richard Bushman about this a lot. Yeah. And we see eye to eye on it. I believe that we ought to tell these things to our people as soon as we can. But, you know, when it's told to you by somebody who believes, it just doesn't affect you the same way as when it's told by someone who comes up to you and says, hey, you know, you want to see what I've discovered and your church lied to you about it. Quite often what happens with people, it's not so much the particular fact or story or whatever it is. It's the sense they've been lied to. Or that they haven't been told the full story, and therefore, what else has the church deceived them about? I was 50 years old before I heard of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and so on and so forth. I don't doubt that that happens. Now, I've sometimes come back to people and said, well, you know, gee, I wish you'd been reading more, because honestly, I'm not making this up. My mother had Juanita Brooks' book about Mountain Meadows, two of them, in her library. I read them both when I was a teenager. I've known about this stuff since I was a kid. I knew about polygamy early on. I heard about a lot of these things. So it lost any capacity it had to bother me. It doesn't shock me or surprise me. But somehow people get that old in the church. Many of us, frankly, don't read. Mm-hmm. We're at the video store or, you know, on the movie channel or something. And then all of a sudden they're preparing a lesson. They look something up on the internet. Boom, there it is. The church has been lying to me all my life. And I feel terrible about cases like that. I think to an extent, it's their fault because they haven't been reading, they haven't been paying attention. I've had people who tell me, man, the church suppressed the idea of multiple versions of the first vision. It published them in The Ensign, for heaven's sake. They've been published by Deseret Book and Bookcraft, BYU Studies, everywhere, you know. What do we have to do? Come by, knock on your door, make you read it, and then sign an affidavit that you did? You know, I don't know what to do with people like that. On the other hand, it is true that we don't always tell the full story. And I would rather that we do. I'm not. I think the best response to this is to tell our story honestly and in an unvarnished way.
Is there a trend towards that?
I think there is.
Starting? I sense it too. Do you have any stories you can share without, I mean, you name names or not, but what evidence do you have?
I think the Joseph Smith Papers Project is a really good one. I think the Mountain Meadows Massacre books are a great important step. You know, I've been having a dialogue with some people just today about Mountain Meadows Massacre and, you know, and was that book a lie? Was it trying to whitewash the church? I think, good grief, no. I mean, it points the fingers at stake presidents and local leaders and so on. The members did it. It basically exculpates the Indians.
Right.
That's exactly what needed to be done. Should have been done a long time ago. But I think I understand reasons why it wasn't. But now it can be. I think Richard Bushman's book, Rough Stone Rolling, was a step forward in this. I'd like to see more of that kind of thing. I think we're getting better at it, and I think it's a sign of maturity. And I am so far from advocating a whitewashed history, it couldn't be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess my question is, from the people I listen to, or at least who I'm in dialogue with on my end, it's like, okay, Juanita Brooks, tough life once she started bringing this out.
Yeah.
Grant Palmer... Not a whole lot of respect coming from the people who are reviewing his book to even acknowledge in the early part of this putting this information out or whatever that they were onto something.
Yeah.
Is it just human weakness? Is there? I mean, somewhere along the line, I guess I would love to hear you share. She might. I can see a little more easily. She was a heroic figure of some sort.
And she remained a faithful Latter-day Saint.
So more than perhaps Grant or whatever. But, you know, when Mike Quinn gets pretty much... Yeah. I mean, again, I'm one of these guys that have known Mike Quinn for 20 years. And so when I hear these certain portraitures of him, I'm like Joseph Smith of polygamy. I want to give Mike the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And I don't hear that coming always from the apologetics.
Well, let me say something.
And
first
this is
about
divorce you from the discourse because I know I'm going to say that sometimes you do.
Oh yeah,
get your unfair a little bit maybe, but
never
but
unfair. For always just.
Okay, all right.
I'm the personification of justice.
Oh man. That'll be the clip that somebody is going to edit out here and lift that up. But yeah, I'd love to hear more of a. Okay, I know I'm doing a job when I'm overseeing a journal of apologetics.
Yeah.
Versus, everything I'm publishing really fair, or is it just fair because it's within the game of apologetics?
Well, I'll tell you how I edit. I'm a very laissez-faire editor. I am. For that matter, economically laissez-faire. I'm a libertarian.
Okay.
So it affects my editing too.
Hang yourself. Yeah. Is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, sort of. So what I tell people is, look, I go to someone and I say, would you write a review? They ask, how long? As long as you think you need it to be. What approach should I take? Whatever approach you feel like taking. I do not dictate what people write in the review. I don't.
But you publish it.
Yeah, I do. But I ask interesting people, I think interesting people, to write. Now, Juanita Brooks obviously was gone long before we came along. I think she was not treated particularly well by local church leaders. But she died, as I understand, that a faithful Latter-day Saint. And, I respect her. I think very highly of Juanita Brooks. Grant Palmer, I'm more critical of, because I disagree with him more fundamentally. I mean, that's simply the fact. But when I went out to get people to review him, I'll tell you, at first I had a hard time getting anyone to review the book. No one wanted to. They were all busy. Historians are just busy, busy, busy. At least they tell me they're busy. But there was some sort of looming big deadline for the Joseph Smith Papers project. It was really hard to get any of them to give me the time of day. I actually, at one point, got Jill Durr to convene a meeting of the Smith Institute. And I made the pitch to them and said, please, somebody, some historian, I don't care who, just somebody with a historical background, would you write a review for me? And finally, Steve Harper said, yeah, I'll do it. Well, then to my astonishment, after his was promised, several more came in. I mean, Davis Bitten wrote a little essay he just sent to me, not for publication. I said, Davis, can I run it? Yeah. Mark Ashurst McGee wrote one for me. Lou Midgley wrote something for me. Eventually, Jim Allen wrote something for me too.
But you feel obligated to publish them all?
I thought they were all interesting.
Interesting, even though...
I didn't recruit. People will say, wow, what overkill. You know, you went out and got 6 reviews, because there were 5 reviews and a statement from the Smith Institute. Mm-hmm. I actually only recruited one. Mm-hmm. The others came in, and I thought, it's James Allen. Yeah, I'm going to run James Allen. Mark Ashurst McGee, I've always wanted to have something by him.
But if you look at the review and you say, well, this isn't scholarship, this is.
But I think they are.
Rhetoric.
I don't think they're rhetoric.
Okay.
See, we'd probably disagree on this.
Well, I would at least say that to some
they're
degree.
They're rhetorical.
Okay.
But, hey, Herodotus is rhetorical. Thucydides is rhetorical. It's still history. Good history, Edward Gibbon. Edward Gibbon is definitely rhetorical. I don't mind a historian who's arguing for a thesis. In fact, I would argue, and we've gone the rounds on this one for years with I and various critics, about objectivity in history. I say it's impossible and undesirable.
Sure.
Peter Novick.
And I don't have any problem with that.
So they'll say, you're in favor of just relativism, that anything is true. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I don't mind that a historian comes along and writes a kind of partisan history. I like to read Marxist histories. I like to read feminist historiography. It's challenging to me. It wakes me up. It gets me thinking down new paths, and I've learned really important things from some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't mind knowing, okay, this guy's a Marxist, so I'll keep that in mind.
Sure.
Tell me, I'm a believing Mormon, and I'm coming at this as a believing Mormon. I'm happy with that. You want to do Catholic history? I'm happy with that, too.
So if you weren't editing the Farms Review, and you were editing... an American history reviewer, I don't know where Grant's would be.
Yeah.
His would be some sort of mixture of theology and psychology and who knows whatever else. But if you're editing one of those, would it be a different editorial approach?
Yeah, it probably would be. I mean, look, some people say, well, the Maxwell Institute is partisan. Well, of course we are. That self-avowedly so.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we're dishonest. You can judge us by what we produce. And if you find a flaw, fine. That we're putting them out in the public marketplace of ideas, go after them. That's what it's about. And we'll go after you. And out of all of this, the truth, we hope, will come out. I'm for a vigorous exchange of ideas.
But and not within the pages of the magazine.
Well, now that's funny, because several people have said, well, he refuses to take letters to the editor. I've only had two requests. And in both cases, the people who asked to do letters withdrew the request before I even got an answer back to them. So it's never really come up.
So people, would you publish reviews of reviews if they were submitted?
You know, I've toyed with the idea. We never have, and at some point I began to get worried about an infinite regress, and I think, well, but there are other venues. Hey, believe me, there are lots of critics out there, and they don't seem to lack megaphones for going after the Farm's Review. So I thought, this is my little corner of space. This is our little bully pulpit. You've got yours.
Okay, and that is a question I want to do. It's like an insider discussion.
But there are disagreements even inside it. And we've published things. Like, we published an attack on Mormonism by Carl Mosher and Paul Owen, for instance. I've published Michael Heiser attacking my own piece on Psalm 82, the Year of God's passage.
Would you publish that without a supporting one ever?
Probably not.
Okay, so...
No, probably not.
So if it is negative as far as Mormon truth claims, you would probably always
probably
want to
publish a response, because we are not impartial.
Right.
You know? So I don't pretend to be.
Okay, so that's fine and all that stuff. I guess it's just... I worry... This is maybe my larger question. The apologetic enterprise, in many ways, I think, pushes away... I'll say people who were raised within the church come to these questions at some point in their life, and then they don't see the messenger who helped them at least into this new questioning space or whatever. They don't see those people honored at all as having something behind it.
Yeah.
Isn't there something about the DNA in the Book of Mormon that really should be acknowledged in even an insider discourse as being... I can see why somebody would be upset about this.
I think I've actually said that. I think I've actually written that in print.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm fight against the general impression that I'm giving you here with either specific things or not. Yeah. But I guess that whole idea of here I am reading an apologist thing. I'm supposed to go to these websites and join these discussions. And basically it's like, oh, you're crazy for even... worrying about that because of these five reasons, and there's no acknowledgement of the gut punch.
I don't think that we've typically said you're crazy for worrying about these issues. Some people may perceive it that way. It's not the way I feel. But I'll tell you, I hear people write to me all the time and say, man, you're the reason I lost my testimony of the church.
Really?
So on and so forth. First of all, I'm not sure they're telling the truth, because I'm trying to think, okay, it was your silly arguments for Mormonism that convinced me it was false. And I think, nah.
You didn't have enough depth for me.
Yeah, I'm thinking this might be a nice rhetorical point to score. You think you're scoring on me, but I'm not sure I credit it. But even if it's true, I get lots of notes from people saying, wow, that was really helpful. I mean, I've had an exchange with a person just within the past couple of days, very concerned member of the church. I suggested several things for him to read, and I frankly didn't expect the sort of gushing response. It was, oh, man, thank you. That settled all my concerns on that issue. It really took care of everything. I'm feeling great now. Well, I get that kind of thing, maybe not quite that enthusiastic, but I get that kind of response regularly. And so there are people out there who say, yeah, you've driven me away from the church. There are a lot of people who say, hey, you really helped keep me in the church. And, now, do I have quantificational information on that? No, I don't. I have no idea. But I think, by and large, the effects have been positive. Now, can we improve our tone and so on? Yeah, probably so. And we've tried to be careful. Believe it or not, I edit out a lot of stuff.
You're the little devil on your left shoulder
wants to put in.
Okay.
You're
talking about in the journal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And here's the other thing. People have said, man, you are so nasty. Believe me, I have held back on nasty things I could have said. I personally. I've known things, nasty personal details about people that I think my critics would expect me to use. I have never used them. Never. I wouldn't do that. Never. There's a fellow out there right now that claims that I'm the one who outed Mike Quinn, and I'm the guy who kept him from being hired at any one of the 2,000 to 4,000 American colleges. And apparently, I'm this practically omnipotent, but boundlessly evil being who's just devoted his life to that sort of thing. I haven't done any of that. None of that. I didn't. I didn't spread any rumors. I was, in fact, on that issue of Mike's orientation, his sexuality, Todd Compton and I heard it about the same time from the same person. I think we were about the last people to know, partly because I'd been out of the country. So this idea that I sort of masterminded some conspiracy to personally discredit him, it's just flat out false. I didn't do anything of the kind, nor would I have. I don't do that kind of thing. And like I say, I've sat on things that I've known, stories that I've known and so on, that I could have used to great rhetorical effect, but it would be unethical for me, and I won't do it. But I've also, because I, frankly, I enjoy the give and take, and I have a little fun with it. I have more than a little fun with it. People need to understand I'm laughing most of the time, and I'm not laughing in some nasty, sneering laugh. I'm just having a good time.
So this is your 2 hours a day on message boards and stuff you're talking about here.
But then I see things come in sometimes that are written by people who I think, this sounds arrogant, but I think they're trying to sort of imitate what I do. Only instead of using a rapier, they're using a meat axe. And I don't appreciate that. It's one thing, it seems to me, to write a piece such that someone will read it and conclude, man, the target of this is an idiot. It's another thing to come out and say, this guy is an idiot. I won't do that. Now, if I think he's really, and there's some I think are real idiots or just plain dishonest, like Ed Decker, I won't say that he is. But I'll give you example after example where I think at the end, if you're thinking rationally, you will conclude that this man is not honest. He's not careful.
So is that
what
gets you going more than anything else? It's when you feel like it's not coming from an honest inquiry.
Right. It does. Yeah, that gets me going.
So is that where like a Simon Southerton doesn't gain your respect to where a Juanita Brooks would? Kind of thing.
To an extent, I think Juanita was really struggling with a serious issue. You know, these are people she'd known growing up, and so on. And then to find out, to me, just by the way, as an aside, to me the really interesting aspect of the Mountain Meadows massacre is that it was done by good people, and I mean by that there's a moral tragedy here.
Right.
And I actually reading Massacre at Mountain Meadows, I kept thinking, you know, if I were a playwright, I would love to compose almost a Greek tragedy out of this, how there's a certain inevitability to what's happening. It has its own awful logic, and it moves toward this conclusion. You can see it coming, and standing outside, I want to scream, no, 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 stop.
Right.
But I can see why they're doing what they're doing, and it just keeps going from step to step. But what interests me about it is they're not bad people. If they'd been thugs before and they were thugs after, well, there's nothing interesting about that. It's horrible, but it's not interesting. What makes it fascinating in a terrible way, is they were good citizens before, good citizens after, and just for those few days, they did this unspeakably
lost
awful
perspective
thing.
And,
yeah, and that's the challenge to me, and the moral challenge. You know, could I, if I'd been in a situation like that, have done something like that?
Right.
Otherwise, it reminds me of Hannah Arendt's comment about Adolf Eichmann, you know, the banality of evil, that when she met him and interviewed him, she thought she'd been told that he was some sort of superhuman monster. And he just turned out to be this unpleasant little German accountant.
Yeah.
And that was unnerving in a way. And she said, you know, we're sort of flattering ourselves by saying, well, he's a different species. I could never have done something like that. But when you meet him, you realize, no, he's actually sort of like me. He might have been an unpleasant neighbor or something, but that's the worst.
Right.
But under those circumstances, he did what he did. And so I really respect Juanita Brooks for doing what she did. Simon Southerton, I can see why a person would come to the conclusions that he does. I don't think he's right. And I think that, I think that we have the better genetic argument.
Do you?
Yeah,
okay.
I do.
And I don't know the genetic arguments, but almost nobody that I hear thinks that you guys are even close.
Yeah.
We were
really advantaged by the fact that we happen to have some very, very prominent geneticists who are Latter-day Saints, active. And one of them, in fact, told me he's won all sorts of awards. He's still relatively young, not at BYU. He's won all sorts of prizes nationally and internationally. And he said to me, you know, I think one of the reasons I won all these prizes was maybe to put me in the position where when this topic came up, I could respond with some authority. And I think we have, and he has. And
so, what is the takeaway of that response?
The takeaway
that
of the response
would be natural that this DNA would be lost.
Would just be lost. I mean, you wouldn't be able to identify it. And one of the studies that came out relatively recently was a study of Iceland, where it turns out there's no genetic evidence for the existence of the ancestors of most of today's Icelanders. Or to put it another way, that most of the people living in 1800 in Iceland have no genetic representation that we can discern in the population of Iceland today. Now, we know they existed. We know they were the great-great-great-grandparents of today's population. And undoubtedly, there were some cases of adultery and so on, but not on that massive a scale. What that means is genetic traces can disappear more easily than we'd thought. And so you compare the relatively stable, isolated condition of Iceland with Mesoamerica, with a small group coming 2,600 years ago, not 1800 AD, but 600 BC. The genetic bottlenecks, the wars, the diseases, the conquest, all these sorts of things. Talking about a genetic signature, Soraya's, we don't even know what it looked like. What are the odds you're going to find
it? Now, that actually leads me to a whole line of questions here that I think maybe it's time to address. I want to reserve the right to come back a little bit towards the tone of apologetics and whatnot. But right there, you've basically assumed a farm's argument, which was this was not an empty land when Lehi and his people came here.
Right.
And I'm fine with that. I think internal evidence within the Book of Mormon at least suggests that.
And archaeologically, it's inescapable.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And yet, it doesn't seem like the rhetoric of that makes its way to General Conference. It certainly isn't represented too heavily in CES.
Right.
We're still telling, instead of Mesoamerica, which farms is advanced, it's like you guys are advancing doctrine that the church doesn't teach.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is that frustrating to you? Is it?
Yeah.
How would you want that whole piece to change?
Well, we're not trying to set doctrine for the church. We don't arrogate to ourselves that right. But we do try to read the scriptures and come to our own understanding of them with the best science and historical data that we can muster, presuming that the scriptures are true.
But not necessarily presuming that the earlier modern Mormon prophets got it right when they were saying the narrow neck of the land is Central America.
And this is dicey territory, because a lot of people out there accuse us of rejecting the early prophets.
Should we bother with today's prophets when you're rejecting them there?
But I see it this way. You know, one of the quotes that's used against me and others very commonly is Marion G. Romney recalling an experience where he's standing on the Hill Cumorah, the Drumlin in upstate New York, and seeing in his mind's eye the battles that happened there. And they'll say, look, this man was a prophet, seer, and revelator, and he says that the Hill Cumorah was the place of the final battle. I don't read it that way. I read it as, here's Elder Romney standing on, and it doesn't matter whether he's President Romney or Elder Romney. I'm not trying to play that game. But he's remembering standing on the hill and imagining the battle. Well, I can imagine the battle at Gettysburg or something, but it doesn't mean I've got it exactly right. I may have misconceived where Pickett's charge was or something like that. He thinks that Hill Cumorah is in New York is the place of the final battle, because that's what everybody assumed for years and years and years. So he goes up, and in his mind's eye, he imagines the battle. That's not a claim of revealed doctrine that this is the hill of the final battle. This is a person reflecting on the text of the Book of Mormon, assuming that he's standing in the place where that happened. I don't see it as an authoritative statement that was the Hill Cumorah of the final battle. Does that mean I'm denigrating Elder Romney? No, I'm not. But I don't even think his point in that talk was to identify the precise GPS coordinates of the final battle. His point was something else entirely. And I say, take his point. Don't get sidetracked with that sort of thing. You know, it's like going to Isaiah and having him talk about the four corners of the earth praising God, and then thinking the main point of that is something about geography.
Yeah, that's correct.
It's not.
Yeah. I remember the one that I always think of is President Kimball saying exactly 150 years ago today on April 6th, you know, and somehow April 6th all of a sudden became this Jesus' birthday and this and that and the other thing out of just him noting it was 150 years ago.
Yeah. And that's the same kind of thing, exactly. And I think let's be really careful in reading the remarks of prophets to distinguish claimed revelation from things that are just asides, reflections on generally accepted ideas and so on. I mean, Paul uses Septuagint passages that actually misrepresent the original Hebrew sometimes. Doesn't mean we have to prefer Paul's Septuagint reading to the Hebrew or something like that. Just what's the point he's trying to make? That's what it's about, not that he's doing text criticism on the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I understand the charge that we're denigrating or turning our back on the former prophets, and it's a difficult one for me to address. Because I guess my conception of the role of the former prophets is just different in some ways. To my mind, I'm upholding them. I believe them absolutely. I'm a really, really, really solid believer. I accept Elder Romney as a prophet, seer, and revelator. I accept President Kimball as a prophet, seer, and revelator. But I don't give him inerrancy, and I don't think he would have claimed it.
Right.
And I think if I'd asked Elder Romney, so, did you receive a revelation there saying this is the precise GPS location of the final battle? He would have said, what? I wasn't even thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. So in what ways are these guys, so what makes them that you can support them as a prophet?
Well, because I think sometimes when they are speaking, they do really speak by revelation. I take... In a speech like that, President Romney is affirming the historicity of the Book of Mormon and the moral lesson to be learned from the decline of the Nephites and Lamanites. That's an entirely legitimate point. I absolutely agree with that. And I think that was the point that he was trying to make, not anything about geography.
So why does that make him a prophet to make... You could make that point. I could make that point. We're not prophets.
I could. And I take a fairly minimalist view.
Okay.
I don't think that the brethren are led at every moment...
Right.
By God.
Obviously, you
know. That line's going to be misused.
Oh,
I know.
Sorry. Okay, you so...
Let me explain what I mean by that, which is they do receive revelation, but it's not every minute of the day. And a lot of the time they're left to struggle with problems. They struggle with them. They work their way out. They pray to the Lord to see if the Lord is okay with the way they go ahead on this problem, and they get confirmation or not. Sometimes the revelation is spectacular. 1978 apparently was quite spectacular, unmistakable for everybody who was there. I've heard of other cases like that. In other cases, I think they're just operating with the best will in the world under the best inspiration they can get, but they wouldn't claim necessarily this is revealed. They'll say, this is a pilot program to see how this works. Or this is my reflection on this passage. It reminds me of a comment a friend of mine, a member of the 70, told me about. Of course, he's not sustained as a prophet, seer, and revelator, but he said he was reading the Book of Mormon with his son. He was in an area presidency in Europe, and his son asked him, well, what does this passage mean? I don't get it. And his father, who's a former academic colleague of mine, said, well, this is what I think it means. And he explained it, and his son said, I don't think so. I don't think that's what it means. And his father said, well, you must agree with what I said because I'm a general authority. And his son said, oh, get real. And the father told me this story and just doubled up laughing, you know, because, of course, he was messing with him. But the point is, a lot of the time they're reading the scriptures and they read them just like we do. But sometimes, and in uniquely authoritative ways, the revelation comes for the church.
That's what I was saying. And you don't claim that other people can't have staggering spiritual experiences who aren't LDS, similar to this 1978. But you're saying legitimately within Mormonism too, God can really fundamentally break through with something real and genuine.
Yeah. No, I believe
every
that
once in a while.
God is playing a three-dimensional chess game.
Okay.
And that he's moving a lot of pieces on this chess game that are outside the church. Okay. And there are people out there getting revelation and inspiration. They're getting it inside the church and outside of the church. Mm-hmm. Uniquely about the brethren is they have the right to dictate to the church. But I don't think that the Savior appears to them every morning to give them their to-do list for the day or something like that. They don't claim that sort of thing. But I also reject the claim that he never communicates his will to them, because I think he does.
Mm-hmm. In a special way that really gets through the autobiography and the expectation, all the postmodern...
Yeah.
stuff.
Well, I know, and I won't go into detail because I don't think I'm at liberty to do it, but I know of a church policy that was put in place in one area of the church by a member of the 12 who described it as one of the clearest revelations he's ever received. And he launched a program which apparently is doing really, really well. And, and he said it was just unmistakable when it came to him that was what he needed to do. So, but I've had that experience. I mean, it's not restricted to leaders of the church. One that I will tell, you know, back to autobiography a little bit, is I had an experience with a son in Jerusalem who was fairly young, and he had a slight deformation of his throat. It constricted at a certain point, and so occasionally he'd get things stuck in his throat. He got a piece of meat stuck in his throat in the Jerusalem Center, and it just wouldn't go. It just wouldn't go. And you can imagine, it's terrifying. You feel it's like he's choking. Not quite. He was getting air, and we let him sleep overnight. He woke up the next day, still had this in his throat. And we thought, okay, we've got to do something. So we got together, the elders' quorum president there, a student in the Jerusalem branch, and he and I gave him a blessing. And I was prepared. We were going to take him to Hadassah Medical Center and get somebody to look at this and get it out of his throat. But I'd sort of thought to my mind, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give him a blessing of comfort, reassurance, be calm, medical care is there, we'll get you there in just a few minutes. I heard myself saying that that this condition will end immediately. And I thought, what? I'm a really cautious person. I don't say things like that. And my wife told me afterwards, she said, oh, great, now he's destroyed his faith in priesthood blessings. Well, immediately after I take my hands off his head, he begins to choke and to gag. And I thought, oh, great, great, it's getting worse. Well, immediately he coughs up the meat.
Yeah.
And it's a small thing, right. But it was stunning to me because I swear it was not me.
Yeah.
I heard myself say it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not intending to say that.
Right.
It was like someone else took possession of me and had me do it. And I just was reeling the whole day from that,
mm-hmm.
that it was as distinct an experience as I've ever had of being used by something, someone outside myself. And if I can receive revelation, and I've had prophetic dreams and things like that, not that many, but a few, where I just knew something was going to happen that was so unlikely, and yet it did. I saw it happen. I knew exactly how it would happen. I knew what it would look like, all that sort of thing. And it's happened. And I wonder, what is the point of this? Why? I had one on my mission that was really distinct. Trivial as could be, but very specific and fulfilled within about 8 hours, exactly the way I saw it. I thought, what is the point of this? They weren't weighty issues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one thing they've told me is when I hear people say, you cannot see the future, I say, oh, yes, you can. Maybe that's the only point of those things for me. On a small level, I've done it. I know it's possible. It doesn't happen to me all the time or every year, not even every decade, I don't think. But it has happened very distinctly. And so, to me, those are little testimony reaffirmers. But in other words, I can look at biblical prophecy and people say, it's just not possible to do that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sure it is. If I can do it, surely Isaiah could do it.
So the claims about prophecy is always really, really general up until the point. Then he's reading it back and he's getting more specific. How do you look at that? Is it just factually not?
No, that's an interesting issue, and I think you could say, well, the Book of Mormon is much more specific than
after the
than
fact.
Certain. Although I was just reading something the other day about certain Isaianic prophecies written by evangelicals. And I won't even try to recapitulate it because I'm trying to remember which one it was. But their analysis to me was more interesting than I'd expected it to be. And I thought, I need to go back at this and look at it because maybe I've just discovered a really good example of a very precise predictive prophecy in Isaiah.
Normally someone would say it's third Isaiah.
Yeah.
But
this is for something well past.
Yeah.
It's relating to the life of Christ.
Oh, I see.
And I thought, wow, okay. That's at Book of Mormon level of specificity, if this is right. Now, I have to go back through and check it out because I'm not absolutely sure, and I don't trust this particular evangelical scholar quite.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's right, he's got something good.
Okay, that reminds me a little bit about some more on the Book of Mormon. We talked about, you know, the 19th century pieces that are in there and stuff. Something as specific as Joseph being a character within the Book of Mormon itself.
Yeah.
Is that one of these cases where you would treat it the way that you can get very specific, that the ancient Joseph really could have done that? Or are you comfortable at all with something like Joseph's mind wandering as he's translating and
I'm trying to buoy up. Yeah, I'm not very comfortable with it, but let me tell you how I would view a situation like that. I tend toward Blake Osler's view of God's foreknowledge.
Foreknowledge.
Not on the text.
Not on the.
Yeah, I don't believe in a fixed future.
Okay.
I believe that in a lot of cases, God's foreknowledge, his prophecies, are not so much prophecies of things that will happen, but declarations of what he's going to make happen. Hmm. You know, I'm powerful enough. When the time comes, this is how it's going to go down. And I've thought with the Joseph and Joseph thing, maybe that's part of a sign that God is telling about, something he's going to do. Here's my personal autobiographical take on that, because I'm a descendant. I discovered fairly late. My family was not into genealogy, but I'm a descendant of Joseph Knight.
Okay.
Joseph Knight Jr. and Joseph Knight Sr., all right? Now, when the prophecy says there's going to be a Joseph and his father's name will be Joseph, I think to myself, how interesting that there was a Joseph Knight Sr. and Jr. in the nearby area, each just a few years younger than the Smith counterpart.
Right.
Was there a backup team?
Yeah, I've heard that argument.
Yeah. If the Smiths hadn't come through, were the Knights going to come through? They've been called the second family of the Restoration, right? Maybe that's how God does it. He says, well, I'm going to do this because this will be a sign to people. It'll be a Joseph and a Joseph. But in case this one doesn't do it, I've got another one. And there might have been a third, for all I know.
Yeah.
There may have been one before Joseph Smith. How do I know? Who didn't do it. So in some cases, it's not so much a matter of peering into the future and discerning it as getting a divine communication about what God intends to do. Mm-hmm. This will be a sign. When you see this, you'll know. This is one of the marks of authenticity. Yeah. That I'm going to do it in this way.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. We with the just, we shall dwell.